This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
Well, it happened. Brian Koberger has confessed to the murders. Today, we're going to be diving into the latest seismic developments in the Brian Koberger case, one that's left families, the public, and even seasoned legal experts stunned. After nearly 3 years of a steadfast denial, intricate legal maneuvering, and just weeks away, one of the most anticipated trials, I'd say, in probably a decade. Koberger has abruptly pled guilty to murdering four University of Idaho students. It's a twist that's as shocking as it is confounding, raising pressing questions about the true motivation behind Koberger's 11th hour decision. Joining me to try and make sense of this from a legal perspective, defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis. I was shocked this week when this all went down. What was your initial reaction when you heard that Koberger is going to plead out?
Pretty surprised that the plea was even extended at this point.
Yeah.
You know, look, usually in a death penalty case, it's prudent. If you're going to plead it out as a prosecutor, take death off the table, put the person in prison for the rest of their life. Make that decision early on. So you're saving the victim's families all of this heartache and turmoil and trepidation about an upcoming trial. You're saving the government money if you do that. I was sort of surprised that it came down this close to trial. I'm just wondering sort of what motivated the prosecutor to do it now and not 2 years ago or something.
Well, and that's a big question. From what we understand is that the ask, hey, can we get a plea deal came from Koberger's team. They're the ones who came to the prosecutor and said, what do you got? You got anything? You want to offer us something? And they came back and they said, okay, we'll agree, take death off the table for this. I guess why? I mean, do we know if something like this was offered way back when, or why would we wait all of this time if we're going to ever extend that olive branch? Almost 3 years in, all of this hell, all of this money, if we're ever going to do it, why not try it back then?
Totally. And you know, you look at, if this had been a case where defense had been super successful in motions practice and excluded a bunch of experts and stuff, and, you know, the prosecution had a good case in the beginning and then towards trial, they're like, we got some problems. Now we got to plead it out. It's one thing, but that's not what happened here. The defense, though they made valiant efforts, did not really damage the prosecution's case during its entire pendency. And so, you know, if you're sitting pretty a few weeks before trial, your case is almost as strong as it was in the beginning. I just don't get extending it now. If as a prosecutor, you're going to be okay with this kind of plea offer, the Band-Aid off, get it over and done with in the beginning, save everybody money and heartache and everything else. And they didn't do that.
Was this, a case where, really the prosecution never intended to offer them anything, but it just kind of came to the 11th hour and Taylor's exhausted all of her options. I mean, she really has thrown every damn thing out there to see what could stick and nothing really stuck. How do you think this went behind the scenes? Do you think this was a come to Jesus with Ann Taylor and Koberger, or do you think this was Koberger in his kind of weird calculated mode going, we've tried everything, let's do this? I mean, it's conjecture, but what do you think?
I just don't think it could have been that the prosecution was gung-ho on seeking death the whole time, hadn't even considered whether they'd allow this kind of plea offer, and then, defense is asking for it, so now let's think about it. No, at the beginning of this trial, or the beginning of this case, rather, the prosecution absolutely had in mind, hey, do we take death off the table and secure convictions for these four victims and ensure that this person never touches free society again? You better believe they've been thinking about that for years. And so the timing of it, even if it did come at the behest of the defense, prosecution had to have been thinking about this and whether they would agree to it years ago. And if they had agreed to it now, I don't see why their position would have been different 2 years ago and why they didn't just try to resolve it at that point.
Yeah, it is baffling. The families obviously are the ones that are feeling this the worst. And it's a mixed bag. The majority, I would say, from who has spoken out are not happy with this. It's obviously not a majority vote. It's not a vote at all. In fact, very little say, is what we're learning, in terms of their influence on the decision by the DA to accept this plea deal. Steve Gonsalves coming out very angry. Some of the others have come out and said, this is, you know, this is horrible. We've been treated horribly by the DA's office here. Just from a legal standpoint, how do these things normally get handled when it comes to something like this, where you have victims' families that should be considered in the decision? And it seems that, you know, it was a Sunday night PDF that was sent out going, read the attached.
Yeah, in terms of how these are usually handled, not like this. When I was a prosecutor, especially on a death case, if we're considering a plea offer, we got to get in front of that. And so what we and in Colorado and most jurisdictions have a victim's rights law like this. The victims are entitled to be informed of key proceedings and also to be informed of any plea offer and to give input on that plea offer. And the prosecutor has to consider that input, doesn't have to make the ultimate decision. But prosecutor has to consider that. My understanding is that these victims were consulted very briefly days before, and that I think at least one of the victims' families said that they didn't feel they had been adequately informed at all. And so they're sort of left hanging with this, you know, new development in a case involving the death of their child. And they're kind of saying, hey, you didn't talk to us about this sufficiently and you didn't hear us out in terms of what we want. And I think that is absolutely a misstep by the prosecutor if that's how it happened.
What was your reaction when the first order of business during the hearing, the change of plea hearing, was Judge Hippler scolding Steve Gonsalves without basically saying his name? Steve had gone on with Brian Enten on News Nation the previous night, had encouraged people to call the office, to call the judge's office. I mean, it wasn't like go to his house with picket signs. It was call, let your voice be heard. And then the judge's response was, I have not and will not listen. In fact, he's sending him to the authorities should anyone need to listen to the calls. I don't think the intent was go threaten the judge. It was just, we're not happy. And if you're not going to listen to us, I'm going to basically empower all of these thousands of people who are watching and passionate about this as well to be heard. And you're still sitting there going, la, 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 we're going to do it the way we want. I it seemed rather tone deaf, but I mean, I'm just a lay person. What was your thoughts?
I think tone deaf and also a little whiny. Hey, look, you're presiding over a nationally publicized quadruple homicide case, and there's a massive decision coming up that has been polarizing to the public, to that specific community, the public more generally. Look, you're going to get people who have thoughts about that, and deal with it, bro. Like, it's not it's something you need to be complaining about and starting the plea hearing off in a way that sort of implies that one of the victim's fathers did something improper when I don't think they did at all. I thought that was a weird way to start it and just not really becoming of a jurist.
No, I mean, I've appreciated his little more directness in this, where he's not taking a lot of crap and going for everything Ann Coburger asks for. And I think that's been good. But that was a big turnoff of that that moment there in the courtroom. It seemed rather odd. Were you surprised at all by what was revealed in the statement that Bill Thompson gave? I mean, essentially, I've been kind of summarizing it as a mini version of what the opening statements would have been, of what he gave the other day. He laid out what the evidence was. It really wasn't any more than what we already knew about. I mean, or would there have been more things up his sleeve that he just wasn't saying? Because there was nothing shocking there. I mean, it was pretty much everything that we knew about, and less, I think, than what we thought we knew about, even. There was no evidence of contact, according to Bill, of Coburger with the people in that residence. I think we were all thinking there's going to be some sort of a something. Nothing. Were you surprised by any of that?
So I was surprised. Yes, I was surprised by the way it was presented and the content of that presentation. So when there's a plea that's going to happen like this, usually the prosecutor lays out either an offer of proof or a factual basis. They're synonymous to say, hey, here are the facts that would be presented that justify a person pleading guilty to a crime because, like, hey, we could back it up and they're going to be convicted. But yeah, it was rather limited. It was, you know, not no bombshells that we haven't heard about. And I wonder if, you know, the victims' families were kind of hoping for something a little bit more gung-ho, a little bit more impassioned and incriminating for Brian Koberger. But this was the way the prosecutor chose to do it. And I'll note that, you know, this is kind of a smaller jurisdiction and they're not used to handling huge murder cases and having, you know, four victims' families listen to every word they say. So perhaps that affected what that record was like.
Let's talk about that for a second, because that's another thing that ran through my mind as Bill Thompson was up there speaking the other day. This is a case where the prosecutor doesn't have a lot of experience in prosecuting murder cases. You know, it was a very low number. I don't remember exactly what it was, but, and there's certainly nothing to this level. The idea of this thing going to trial, which it was about to do, Ann Taylor's a pretty good attorney. I mean, granted, you know, she's exhausted every damn option here. I think she would have been a formidable person to fight for Bill Thompson with his, you know, just lack of experience for where he is and being a small town DA. And then you have the jury question. This is more personal than it is legal, but were you confident this thing, if it had gone to trial, that there would have been a conviction, or was there enough reasonable doubt where, you know, there was a good chance Koberger could have walked away from this thing, and maybe this is the best outcome for everyone?
You know, there's always a thought that when we're talking about smaller jurisdictions, they could be overwhelmed by a case. They might not have the expertise and experience and resources to adequately do what needs to be done. You look at kind of the Barry Morphew case, another case out of Colorado. That was in a rural jurisdiction. That prosecutor messed it up so bad, the case got dismissed and she got disbarred. And so the real problems can arise under those circumstances when you have this monster case and this rural or you know, smaller jurisdiction that might not be ready to handle it. And so does that create a greater likelihood of an acquittal? I think it does.
Let me get your reaction to what we actually saw in the courtroom the other day. Brian Koberger standing up, even when he didn't really need to stand up, and the judge telling him to sit down. That was a weird moment to me. Just the body language itself. So we'll put on your psychological hat for a moment. Ann Taylor stood up and did her part, addressed the judge as she needed to, and he was sitting there fidgeting. He was like just waiting, like, is it my turn to stand up and get the participation trophy award? And then he did, very awkwardly. It was like a third grader, and stood there at attention, his hands at his side. And I know he has autism and, yeah, all that. But there was, I don't know, the word I'm going for is basking. It felt like he was kind of basking in the moment. Like it was, I'm here. This is the time. I'm going to stand now. And he's like, sit your ass down. Take your oath and sit your ass down, basically. It wasn't a, yeah, I'm sad. I did it. It was, yep. What was your take on his personality?
That was kind of my impression too. And hey, that's just speculation. I don't know what's going on in this person's mind, but it was kind of like a, hey, look at me moment. And, you know, under the most, you know, dark and gruesome circumstances you can think of. So pretty eerie. And yeah, that was kind of my impression too, is that he was like, oh, this is, you know, my time to shine and proclaim, you know, what I have done here that has gripped the nation and have everyone give me all that attention. That was kind of my take on it.
It was creepy. I watched some of Brian Enten's interview that evening with Catherine Ramsland. We've had her on the show before. She hasn't been able to talk about any of the Koberger case until now. She was on the witness list. And she gave the first interview to Brian and talked about, you know, what he was like while he was a student of hers. And according to her, she didn't really feel any red flags. And, you know, rightfully so. Sometimes these people just slip through the cracks. You know, he was very astute. He was very respectful. And I honestly, you know, you look at him, I wouldn't have expected anything different. I didn't expect her to say like, oh, he was creepy and weird, maybe a little weird, but she said none of the above. But she is curious, and Brian posed the question, would you be interested in studying him? Given your unique closeness to this case and to him and having known him prior to any of this. And she said, yes, she'd be very interested in doing that. And I'm paraphrasing her answers to a certain extent. But I guess the question is that something that can be done, that should be done, is going to be allowed to be done? Obviously, there is a psychological component to this. She studied BTK, wrote a big book on him. And some of those studies have gone on to help other people in criminal justice learn about their cases, learn about their subjects and people like this. It feels like that's what Koberger wants. I mean, again, it's conjecture, but it feels like this is the track he's wanted to go down and live in infamy. What tools are going to be at Koberger's disposal to live in infamy, and what tools are not going to be at his disposal to go down that road when going forward after being sentenced?
Yeah, I would totally expect there to be a psychological thorough evaluation and study of him. You know, he's a peculiar character. He's got that autism diagnosis. He's a PhD student in criminology, and then he admitted to, you know, slaughtering four innocent college students. So yeah, I think we should look at that, absolutely. And then one thing too that's interesting, my firm administrator Thomas Roan, I don't know if he's watching, but he put up a really important point that I didn't think of. Yeah. Maybe Koberger, in pursuing his PhD in criminology, was trying to study himself.
Yeah.
Maybe he was trying to learn more about what he's like. Why is he having these feelings? Why is he having these thoughts? Why does he have impulses to go out and harm people? I just thought that was a curious insight that might be telling in terms of the path that Koberger chose educationally and now criminally.
I agree. I've been saying something to that effect all along, where it feels like he wanted to get on the ride, basically. You know, he wanted to go on that ride. My theory on it all along was that there was two options, or maybe more, but all of them he was okay with. One, getting away with this, going and teaching about it, having others teach about him, and being the silent person off to the side going, they're talking about me and no one's the wiser than I am. And then being the genius in the room because he can dissect himself and say, here's how this killer did this and that. And it was so genius. And all these students are going to look at him like he's just wonderful for the first time in his life. That's my guess. But I think he was also cool with this, where worst case scenario, you get caught. And then you get to be like the folks on Mindhunter and studied, and you'll be featured in movies and you'll go down in infamy. I think either way, he was cool. And that's where we're at right now. It feels like no matter where we go, he's still kind of winning. He's still kind of getting what he wanted. And that's what makes the whole thing so sick.
Yeah, and I can't fathom, you know, having a Professor Koberger for my child or something. That would just be so dark. But no, I agree with you. And you know, we see that a lot with these high-profile killers. They have that need. There's, you know, there's an insecurity there. There's, you know, oftentimes they're not getting approval from folks around them in their lives, or not as much as they want. And so they seek out this stuff to have that infamy to substitute for, like, human connection or, like, you know, normal respect and admiration that they might not be getting.
Let me ask you about this.
I thought that's an excuse at all.
Oh, no. No, but it's just, yeah, it's like it's like they're feeding on the opposite of what the system's trying to punish them with. They're like, I'll take more of that. That's delicious. I love eating dryer sheets and antifreeze. It's just like, okay, you have another Tide Pod. One more, I think, on this. The victims are going to be able to give their impact statements when they do the sentencing coming up here in late July. Rightfully so. The judge has set aside roughly 2 days for that, the 23rd and possibly the 24th. Are we going to see Brian Koberger stand up? Let me ask you this, because there's two questions I think a lot of people wonder. Can they require him? This probably would have already needed to be done with the plea. Could there have been a requirement that he has to stand and talk and explain his shit? Or is that completely voluntary? And obviously it goes back to BTK. When he did all of that, he pulled the exact same thing right before trial. I did it, guys. Ha ha. And then he stood up for 45 minutes and went through all of the deal of what he did. Could be horrible for the family to hear. Maybe it could be cathartic. I don't know the answer to that, but the fact that he had to stand there and dish it all out is what took place there. Do you think we're going to see anything like that in this case, or is it just going to be the families telling their part to a very stoic Koberger?
You know, legally, Koberger would not be required to provide his motive or information about how he did this unless it was built into the plea agreement, and it sounds like it wasn't. Mm-hmm. There could have been such a requirement sought that said, hey, we'll not put you in front of a firing squad if you tell us what you did and why you did it. That's not going to happen. But does Koberger have the right to do it? He does. He has the right to allocution, which is essentially making a statement at sentencing on one's own behalf. And so could we hear more, especially if part of his motivation for all of this was to get infamy and to get national attention and that kind of thing? I would be surprised if he got up there and disclosed more seedy details about what he did and why he did it and with the nation watching.
It's going to be a creepy moment when that opportunity is given. Very creepy moment. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, invaluable insight. So thank you so much.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.